I want to take you back for a moment to the founding of the State of Israel, to a story that was told around the time of the founding and was well known then but is not so well known now. That's the story of a kibbutz where, of course, at night they would have shomrim, they would have guards who would patrol the kibbutz because it was still in the time of the War of Independence. And one night Shmuel was supposed to patrol the kibbutz, and the head said, "Look, we don't have any weapons. It's not like we've got rifles or guns or whatever, so take a broom. You'll walk around in the dark, hopefully it will look like a weapon, you can threaten people with it, and maybe if anybody shows up, you'll scare them off." So he takes the broom and he's walking around the perimeter of the kibbutz and he sees something moving, he hears a sound. And he says, "Stop or I'll shoot." And someone slowly, slowly edges out of the forest, and it turns out to be Yossi, and he says, "Yossi, what are you doing? I could have killed you." And Yossi says, "No, you couldn't. I'm a tank." Now, that story reminds us that at the beginning of the founding of the State of Israel, it was really sticks and stones. And it was terrifying. And we were vulnerable. And if you want to know why we were there, I'll take you back a little bit further to the beginning of the same century, to the early 1900s, 1903 to be exact, when a Russian boy was found murdered in the city of Kishinev. And nobody knew who had done it, although it seemed that he was murdered by a relative who, by the way, was later found. But that was the occasion for the resurrection of the blood libel in Kishinev. And people began to set upon the Jews of that city, despite the fact that the President of the United States at the time, Theodore Roosevelt, protested to the Tsar, but no protection was offered. And in 3 days of rioting, almost 50 Jews were killed, many, many more injured, hundreds of houses, 700, 800 were looted and burned to the ground. I can read you a description of from the New York Times. "At sunset, the streets were piled with the corpses of the dead and the bodies of the wounded. Those who could make their escape fled in terror. The city is now practically deserted of Jewish life in 3 days." 2 years later, there was another pogrom because some Jews had returned. In 1905, 2 years after that pogrom and right after the occasion of the second one, was the 7th Zionist Congress. And Joseph Chamberlain told the Congress, "Look, Israel's a mess. We can't give you Israel right now. But today we can give you this part of land that actually now is in Kenya, but it was called the Uganda Plan. And it is open and it is safe. And even though now sitting in 2012 in Los Angeles, this might seem improbable, I want you to know that the head of the Russian Zionist delegation, Klenov, when he heard the proposal, said the Shehechianu. Because he thought, if we don't take this, Russian Jewry is doomed. He thought pogroms would break out all through Russia, and he wasn't far wrong. And so to the Zionist Congress, they brought the Uganda Plan. Among its supporters was Theodore Herzl. Because Herzl knew that the Jews of Europe were in danger, and he wanted to save them. Now I want to tell you what happened when that plan was brought to the 7th Zionist Congress, but I don't want to tell you in my words. I want to read you a short paragraph from the autobiography of Chaim Weizmann, who, as you know, later on became the first president of the State of Israel. "The vote," he said, "was by name. My father voted yes. I voted after him with no. Then the names of the two delegates from Kishinev were called." They both said no. Poor Herzl grew pale, and on that day became a true Zionist. He understood the depth of the tragedy and the depth of the idea, and he resolved upon beginning practical work in the land of Israel, even if slowly, even if symbolically, with a few hundred pounds. I remember what Herzl said to me after the vote. "I do not understand," he said. "The rope is around their necks, and they still say no." "Yes," wrote Weizmann, "the rope was and still is around our necks, and we still say no." That's what it meant to be a Zionist in the early century, in the early part of the 20th century. It was to insist that the only home for the Jewish people is Eretz Yisrael, and that the physical safety of the Jewish people is in the end less important than reclaiming their heritage. We always talk about Israel in terms of the idea that Israel is the place that will make Jews safe, but there was more to it than making Jews safe, or Weizmann would have voted yes. It was about where we would be safe. In fact, later on, when Weizmann was testifying in front of the Peel Commission, and one of the commissioners said to him, "Why don't you take Uganda? It's open, it's easy. We'll worry about Israel later." And by the way, that was part of the promise. "We'll get to Israel later." And you know what Weizmann said? He said, "Sir, that's like my asking you why it is that you drive 60 kilometers to visit your mother when there are so many other lovely old ladies on your street." In other words, it's not yours. It's a beautiful place, Africa, but it's not our cradle. It's not where we were born. And that reality and that truth, that's still true. That is still the case. And it is still difficult to say no. If you don't think it's difficult to say no, then just look at all the Jews who live in Los Angeles instead of in Israel. It was never easy to live in Israel. Not then, and in many ways not now. Every time we think that we rest secure, we discover that we don't. And we all know, sitting here this morning, that Israel suffers from internal problems as well. There are social divisions. There is a system of government that everybody agrees is dysfunctional at best and completely broken at worst. There are all sorts of problems, internal, external. But one of the things we should remember is that the people sitting at that Zionist Congress, almost none of them came from countries with any tradition of democracy. And how is it that all these Jews coming from totalitarian dictatorships moved to the Middle East and established a democracy? It's astonishing. You think Ben-Gurion came from a parliamentary democracy? You think Weizmann came from a parliamentary democracy? I've never seen such a thing, except for the years that he spent in Britain. But that's what moved them. And then you take this remarkable legacy and you put it in the worst neighborhood in the world. And it's not easy. And it has never been easy. And this Shabbat is Shabbat Zachor. And this week is Purim. And it's the week on which Jews are not permitted to forget that the threats of the world are real. And every time we assume that they are not real, we discover to our sorrow that we're wrong. On this day, after all, as you heard, right after the service, we're going to have a lunch for Max Webb, who, as he moved through 18 concentration camps, 18, saw, along with some others of you who survived, that the threats of the world are real. How you react to them, what you do, that's not an easy question. To know that the threat is real doesn't mean that reacting militarily is always the answer. But it means that complacence and indifference, that surely is not the answer. Tonight I'm going to get on a plane with some of you, and we're going to join almost 300 people at the APAC conference. That is 300 people from Sinai Temple and about 10,000 or more from across the country, Jews and non-Jews. And if I could tell you in a short sentence, or actually poem, why it is that we're there, I would tell you the poem of Amir Gilboa, the Hebrew poet. And this is what he wrote. He said, if they show me a stone and I say it's a stone, they'll agree it's a stone. If they show me a tree and I say it's a tree, they'll agree it's a tree. But if they show me my blood and I say that's blood, they'll say it's color. And for thousands of years, that was true of Jewish blood. To the world, it wasn't blood, it was color. And you and I both know that there are millions upon millions upon millions of people for whom that is still true. And yes, it is true that Israel has a tremendous military predominance in the Middle East, but let me ask you a question. What would happen if tomorrow that would reverse? What if those who say Israel is an unfair Goliath in the Middle East, what if the power balance were reversed? Not only would there be no Israel, I suspect that the entire Middle East would be like Kishinev. And that is something that we cannot forget. It doesn't give you a foreign policy. It doesn't tell you who to support or what to do. It doesn't argue for or against military means or diplomacy. Those are the tactics by which you get to the end. But know that safety is of today. That as long as there is hatred, there is danger. And the sad truth is, for thousands of years, we have not succeeded in living without hatred. It is not true, however, that there is no answer. There's a beautiful little story in the autobiography of Marcel Reinecke. I don't know if you know who he is, but you should. He's a German Jew who became by far the most powerful literary critic in Germany through his writings, through a television show, and he survived the Second World War with his wife in the house of a Polish typesetter named Bolek. And he tells the story that one night this Bolek, who was hiding them, drank a little bit too much vodka. And he started babbling to them, and this is what he said. He said, the most powerful man in Europe, you know who he was talking about, says that you two Jews should die. I, Bolek, a powerless typesetter, say that you two Jews should live. Now let's see who wins. And that's why they lived. Because one voice, one heart of goodness, one act of sympathy can save a world. I would tell you that we are in perilous times, but when is that not true? We are always in perilous times. There is always danger. But there is also goodness. There is also power that cares for us, as well as power that would seek to destroy us. There is also a state that miraculously has built itself into a remarkable dynamo economically, politically, and militarily. And there is, thank God, this blessed country. So on this Shabbat Zachor, we remember, but we do not despair. We know that there are many across the world who have learned that when we point to our blood, it is blood. And when you see those thousands of people, Jews and non-Jews, who come to that conference because they believe that Israel means something to the world and that the world must protect it, you know that almost for the first time in our history, we are not alone. There are some Boleks out there. And also, we have learned the lesson of Shabbat Zachor. We've been given the greatest gift of any Jewish world in thousands of years. But every gift requires vigilance, and every gift requires protecting. We can be grateful to God that we have this gift. Now, we must prove worthy of it. Shabbat Shalom.